You are Locked On Suns, your daily Phoenix Suns podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Locked On Suns, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Today, as always, I'm your host, Evan Satter, joined by my co-host, Brennan Clean. You can follow me on Twitter at eSatter. You can follow Brennan on Twitter at BrennanClean14. We both write for the SB Nation Phoenix Suns site, Bright Side of the Sun. We're joining you actually the day after the Suns lost once again. Their 13th straight game, the 28th of the last 30. This time it was 99-111 to the Los Angeles Clippers at home. And they kept it close to the first three quarters. Then as expected, the Clippers kind of blew it open in that fourth quarter. They're with a 9-point deficit in the fourth quarter, and they just blew it open from there. So I guess I'll start off with a quick box scores here and just recap that and then go quickly over to the tank race, because I know probably for me that's one of the main talks for me from last night, because in the first quarter I was actually watching the game alongside Dave King and Gerald Borgette of Hoops Habit on his computer. And I think that was probably what Ryan McDonough and James Jones are doing too, because as we saw last night, the Memphis Grizzlies actually won back-to-back games for the first time all season. They beat the Portland Trailblazers without Damian Lillard because he was celebrating the birth of his child. So with that being said, with now the Suns are really actually creating some separation between everyone else, which I didn't think was going to happen with how the tank race is gone. So I think they have a two-game lead now on the Atlanta Hawks, who now move to number two spot, and Memphis now slides to number three spot, 2.5 games. So I guess I'll quickly transition over to you, Brandon. What's your thoughts on not only that and just the separation the Suns are continuing to get with the number one pick? And really, they're on set to have the 25% chance of the most possibly having the number one pick.
Yeah, it's not locked in. There's still plenty of games. And I guess crazier things have happened. But, I mean, to me, I think, like, so they have three more losses than the Suns right now. The Suns have three more losses than the Hawks right now. And, like, I would maybe believe that things could change if I thought the Suns could win another game this year. That seems pretty unlikely, meaning that they'll probably finish 19-62. And if they don't win again, there's no way for the Hawks to make up that ground, even if they were to lose also every game. I mean, that cushion is the most important thing here, where these other couple teams, I mean, Marc Gasol, Dennis Schroeder, just too good to tank, I guess, completely. And so you're seeing them kind of take advantage of some injured teams and stuff in a way the Suns haven't been able to. Like, the Clippers game, I think, was last night a perfect opportunity where if the Suns had Devin Booker or TJ Warren and were playing a little better, they probably would have won that game. But just injuries and, you know, the rest of the roster being so young, they just have no chance most of these nights. And so I guess in one way that is good, because maybe the end goal of this season was to get this top pick, but it's pretty ugly basketball. I guess you just take what you can get and start watching some Luka Doncic film like we've been talking about. Try to look toward the draft rather than being miserable about each of these losses.
Yeah, the more I continuously go to all these Suns games and the crowds keep getting dwindler, and it's really probably the last few games of the season probably won't be that many people there, because as I found out yesterday, but the Coyotes rankings, their TV rankings this season are actually higher than the Phoenix Suns, so that's how it's going for the Suns this season as far as local goes. But I guess from your perspective, Brennan, I tweeted this last night after the game while I was waiting for Jay Tryon in the media room, and just thinking about, they've lost 20 of the last 30, 13 straight, they've won two games since the new year. Just, I already feel like even though it's a month or 2 months away from the national lottery, whoever they get, whether it's Luka Doncic, DeAndre Ayton, whoever that pick is, he's going to already have so much immediate pressure placed on by everyone in the fan base to be that immediate spark plug.
Yeah, I think that there is an element of that. You had said that to me earlier. I don't remember if it was on the podcast or not. But, I mean, to me, I kind of feel like, so I guess there's pressure to me for every, especially if they do end up with that number one overall pick. That's probably the highest pressure player in the league, aside from the very top echelon superstars. I'd say, you know, even some team, let's say like the Wizards or something. Like, I would say the number one pick going into this year, Markelle Fultz is a different situation, but heading into the year when he was had so much hype, I'd say there was more pressure on him to look good and fulfill his potential than like John Wall to make the playoffs or win a championship. I just think the number one pick is such a big deal. So I think that's true regardless. I think as it pertains to the Suns, though, like as it becomes more likely that they do get that pick, I think that there are some fans that are paying attention to this clearly. But at the same time, like, I kind of feel like there's going to be more pressure on Devin Booker regardless of who it is that they pick in the first round this year, just because he's going to be the difference. I think fans are at least smart enough to understand that a rookie's not going to be generally somebody who makes or breaks your season. And whereas Devin Booker, and maybe if they add a free agent or two, those guys are really going to be the ones who it lands on. So I hope that fans don't do that, because that would be a really frustrating way to kind of wrap up this rebuild, as they finally get this pick they've been coveting and trying to maximize their chances of getting for so many seasons now, and then we ruin it by, you know, over challenging this guy who is still a rookie and will be challenged just like all rookies are.
Yeah, I actually just fired Tankathon.com to check the actual percentages here, and I didn't realize, but Atlanta's actually 2.5 games back as well, so they have a 2.5 game lead on everyone from their one spot, and once you get...
Yeah, they're tied with Memphis. They have the same record.
Yeah, and then once you get to 4, it goes to Orlando 4 games back, and then from there, it's really pretty much down to Phoenix, Atlanta, and Memphis for that top overall pick, and I think right now, like you mentioned earlier, Brent, I think it's pretty much signed sealed that Phoenix is going to deliver the most ping pong balls, which would be the 25% chance number one overall pick, 64.2% chance of top three. So I guess there's a lot to like go through in these last 13 games. There's not a lot of highlights, but Josh Jackson at least is developing more, and I want to touch on him a little bit more, because he had not a strong game last night, per his standards, at least as of late, but 8 of 17 field goals, 18 points, 5 assists, 2 steals, 2 blocks, 3 rebounds. I think the one thing I want to talk about is also his 3 points. He did 4 3-point attempts last night, and that's kind of really, I talked about a lot on the podcast before. I think once you have guys like Luka Doncic or some more shooters around, he's not going to take more than 1 or 2 threes a game, I don't believe. But just what's your thoughts on Jackson? The more and more we keep seeing about Booker and more, and I think Triano's trusting him more with the ball. I think last night I saw probably the most times in the last few weeks, I think, that Jackson was running the point guard a lot alongside even Tyler Ulis.
Yeah, hey, really quick. I mean, I was going to ask you before, but then you transitioned. I actually think it makes sense, because do you think Jackson might represent the team at the lottery, or do you think it's Booker, or it was Booker last year, but what do you, I mean, it's not that important, but it's kind of funny it's fun for me to think about. Who do you think it'll be?
Actually, I'm thinking about, I think it's either going to be Booker again, but I honestly think it might be McDonough.
Yeah.
I think it just might be McDonough himself, because I think he knows, like, this is his thing, and, like, we had to sit through the entire season. I don't know if Booker wants to go back for his third straight lottery, though.
Hey, they should probably have Triano do it, and if he doesn't get the job or whatever, they could at least have him stand there and celebrate his accomplishment, which is pretty big for Suns fans, and then they'll appreciate him even more. I don't think they do it all right now, but if they let him like stand over his triumph of the number one seed in the lottery, maybe it'll change the perception a little bit.
And then just walk over and give the envelope to David Fizdale or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Here you go. I gifted you Luka Doncic. You're welcome.
Yeah, okay, with Josh Jackson also, I wanted to touch on him as well with his defense, because I saw last night 2 steals, 2 blocks. He was very active, at least with him especially, and Marquese Chris. They're both getting a lot more active as far as vocally on defense. I think that's a very positive sign. Those guys are calling out a lot of switches last night, a lot of ices and all that. So what's your thoughts on Jackson, and not only him, but also Marquese Chris continuing to slowly develop in that defensive identity they're trying to create here?
Yeah, one thing that I watch with Chris, especially all the time, when they try to go into a switching defense, which I think that they've toned back on a little bit recently, I'm not sure why, maybe because it wasn't working at all, and simplifying things is an easier way, especially with more young players entering the rotation. I haven't noticed them switching so much, but Chris is miserable at doing that. He calls them when they shouldn't be happening, and then he doesn't even execute it completely all the time. He'll call a switch and then, you know, take a beat too long to actually rotate over, or sometimes it looks like laziness where he's calling a switch just because he's not willing to hustle out to the arc or something like that. So that's gone away, is what I'm saying. It's not been so bad recently. I mean, I think we all can look and watch that the best role for him on defense is protect the rim, use the bulk he's built up this year to kind of be a little more physical around the paint, and he's been doing that a lot more recently. He's not looking for those highlight blocks either. It's really more of a measured approach to defense, I think. Not that he's, you know, a terrifically effective player. That's obviously not coming yet. But I think for him, the big steps have just been to not foul and to play in control. And As we get toward the end of the season, I do think that there has been some progress there. I mean, and then the rebounding too has been the other consistent thing. Where 9 defensive rebounds, 13 total last night. If he can continue to do that, that's going to go a long way for him as well. Because, you know, if you're providing some kind of value like that, you're going to be able to stay on the court. And he also hasn't been able to do that all the time. So a lot of positive signs. And I think Jackson, I mean, continues to make steps as well, for sure.
Now, we're both obviously on Luka Doncic train here, but let's say they are enamored enough with DeAndre and they take him over Luka, number one. Don't you think that, at least from what we've heard from the front office, that Marquese Chriss and Josh Jackson are kind of the perfect guys to cover for a weak, like, shot blocker at this stage of his development, like DeAndre Ayton, where he can cover it on the weak side?
Yeah, I think Chriss makes a lot of sense if he's able to hone that skill set in a little bit better. A better fit for sure to me than Bender is next to a player like Ayton. I think, yeah, Chriss is just more ideal because I think he can play the four more easily, since he can move a little bit better laterally and all that, and does have that explosiveness to protect the rim from the weak side. And then, yeah, I think Jackson, I mean, his length, his ability to force ball handlers toward the baseline, icing, like you're saying, in the pick and roll, and that's going to be more valuable as a skill set when there's a weaker rim protector there, because he's going to be able to control the flow of the offense a little better than somebody like Devin Booker or TJ Warren. So that's kind of what I've been going back to every time we talk about the front court decisions, is like, I'm very thankful that they don't have to make that decision until after the draft, because they're going to be able to see what they land with in the draft and make decision accordingly. And I think that's going to determine a lot of how they see the roster going forward, is which guys are available to them in the draft.
For sure. And I guess I wanted to pivot real back quickly to Josh Jackson before we go to Dragan Bender, who continues to struggle for the Suns over his last few weeks. But with Josh Jackson, I made a comparison on the bright side of the Sun recently. I kind of got a little bit of flack for it in the comments section, but I think Josh Jackson's sort of taking an almost an identical development path like a Brandon Ingram did. He could barely shoot in his first half of his rookie year, then all of a sudden he started shooting better. Obviously not to the subpar levels that Jackson is currently, but he's definitely making plays as an assist maker a lot more. He's rebounding better. He's doing better on defense. So I guess, is what's your thoughts on that sort of comparison between like a guy like Jackson taking those steps for like Ingram could in year two?
Yeah, I think that they're maybe have a similar profile as far as like physically and the advantages that they're able to create. But I think Ingram's a much more smooth, like, fluidity of motion is a lot, I mean, better for him compared to even, you know, that Jackson has made strides there, like looks a lot more in control with the ball in his hands and everything. I think Ingram, you watch him play, and I mean, he's able to run. It's, obviously, he's further along developmentally as well. He's been in the league longer, but he's able to run the pick and roll and create assists and score pretty incredibly for somebody so young. I don't think Jackson's quite there. And then I think, you know, Ingram projects to me as an even better shooter, not just from three, but from all over the court, moving, shooting on the move and driving and all that. Just I think he's able to do all that stuff a little bit better, but I'm not necessarily as versatile a defensive prospect, just because I think Jackson's going to be able to defend point guards better than Ingram. Ingram's a little bit longer, a little bit taller, so I think they're just different enough where I'm not worried that Ingram looks a little better. I think he's maybe physically more gifted and able to create those advantages, but I mean, that's nothing against Jackson.
Yeah, definitely. I think with Jackson, I also wanted to quickly touch on this before we go to Bender, but with him, I think just taking those strides forward the last since January, it's been really impressive to watch. But I guess overall, I wanted to touch on his shooting ability and his shot as of late, because I put a video on Twitter last night about it, and I know you commented about it. We've touched on it a lot on the podcast, but his catch-and-shoot motion on his three really showed in a bad way last night. He had, like, three really bad shots, and really I noticed a lot on his threes, too. He's not elevating as much, so he's sort of, like, trying to tinker with his shot on the fly, it seems like. I think over the last, like, week or so, his shots definitely look different.
It does look like that, especially, like you're saying, on the catch. He has a much different form. He doesn't get as high leaping to shoot. I don't know if that's intentional or if that's just discomfort in the motion that he has when he's just catching and jumping rather than having that running start that he has on pull-up shots, which he obviously shoots quite a few of. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's necessarily, and you're not saying this either, but like, why not tinker with it? You know what I mean? He's getting all this extra opportunity. He should be able to kind of improve on the fly, develop things. Everybody in the organization talks about how much time he spends shooting, and we see it pregame constantly. That's where the majority of his work is coming. So I think, you know, he has to get better as a shooter, and it doesn't look pretty right now, but, you know, he also improved his shooting on the move pretty rapidly this year, so maybe it's just a matter of time with the work he's putting in that it will eventually get better. I mean, I kind of give him the benefit of the doubt with how much progress he's made, but at the same time, I mean, there's probably a decent chance that he never becomes that catch-and-shoot player if it's so ugly right now. I mean, it's just kind of hard to tell.
Yeah, definitely. I think over his last month or so, he's averaging about 17, 18 field goals a game. So they're definitely trying to rapidly adjust his shot on the fly, it seems like. But transitioning over to Dragan Bender, 19 minutes last night, 1 of 5 field goals, 0 of 3 from 3. Only one rebound and 2 assists in those minutes. And he was a team worst minus 18 in that time. Alan Williams took a lot of his minutes last night, 19 minutes. And also Shaq Harrison played 31 minutes. And I noticed a lot of times last night they were playing Jackson at the small ball 4, Chris at the 5. So he was taking a lot of Bender's minutes too. So I guess what's your thoughts on Dragan Bender? And I asked Treon last night about the game, after the game about this, but if he's possibly hitting a proverbial rookie wall with all the minutes he's played over the last few months, he said it's quite a possibility. So that could be what's happening with Bender, because his shot is just not elevating at all. He keeps hitting the front iron. But what's your thoughts on Bender's really poor stretch over the last month? And do you think it's going to continue these last 6 or so games?
I mean, I think maybe playing less minutes, as we saw last night, might actually help him. I think not only do you look at the amount of games he's played in his first, really, like you've been saying, it's his first NBA season, all things considered, and 82 games, everybody talks about it in their first couple of years. That's a big adjustment, especially for somebody like, I almost said Doncic, wow, like Bender, who played internationally and did not play anywhere near the minutes he's been playing. So a heavier load, I think, than he's ever experienced in his life, and especially lately playing 30 or more minutes mostly every night. So we saw Alec Peters, Alan Williams both take up some of those minutes for him last night. And that, I think, will be healthy for him. I think, you know, he's gotten plenty of opportunity to build that rhythm, kind of understand the flow of the season, get his body in shape. I think we've seen some of that stuff come along. So, you know, maybe these last few games, he might be somebody, like you're saying, who kind of takes a back seat, lets these other guys. I think it's important for especially Peters and other guys who have not had that opportunity to get it. And Williams, especially with, you know, mostly a lost season for him, he should be playing even more, I think, than he is. So I don't think that that's a problem at all. And it might, you know, it might actually, you might see his efficiency go up if he's down around 19 minutes like he was last night.
We touched on it all throughout the season on the podcast, but I wanted to, I know you recently mentioned that you're in favor of keeping Bender and Chris, and so am I, just because the new coaching staff should get at least one more look at him, unless they really don't want him at all. But with Bender and Chris, do you have a preference as far as next season, how they're going to – I obviously the roster could be so fluid, we're not going to know how it's going to play out, but do you have a preference right now as far as who should start, Bender or Chris, or should they start together? Or after a year of them together, obviously not playing as much minutes as we thought they would, but 2 seasons in, what's your thoughts on the Chris-Bender pairing?
Yeah, I think if Chris can continue to develop as a rim protector, that combination's easier. I think it's pretty tough because Bender is such a unique player. I think ideally they would not both be starting next year. I think that would be a pretty big, well, depending. I mean, maybe if they get a couple bigs in the draft early, and early in the season they roll with that. I don't know. It's not a terrible thought. But at the same time, I think we haven't seen enough to show that them together on the court really works. I think, you know, unfortunately that is a reason that they haven't done it so much, is it doesn't work. Neither one of them has shown the ability to get, I mean, there's not a lot of players like this in the league, but the big interior scorers, you know, you think of LaMarcus Aldridge, players like that, they have no chance. Neither one of them can defend those guys. I think back to the Pelicans game early in the season when Bookie was still healthy, and they just got smashed. And both of them the next morning at practice when I was there were, I mean, the whole team was talking about it, Triano even, but I talked to Bender one-on-one afterward, and I was like, is there, you know, any comp to dealing with guys like that that you've ever had to deal with in your career? And he's like, no, I mean, it's such a unique battle. And I think those kinds of players for him are just, there's really nothing he's able to do with how, you know, how young and undeveloped his body is and all that stuff. It's just tough. So I think ideally you'd have a different guy with one of those in there that can absorb that a little bit better. I think you saw that with Tyson Chandler. And I think that even if Chandler's not around, they should have a player like that in the roster next year to kind of balance it out a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. They need to at least address two or three spots in the front court next season as far as experience and overall depth of the roster. But I wanted to pivot over real quick to the guard situation, because last night was a really interesting night to follow for the point guard situation for next year, because I think that training camp battle between Tyler Ulis and Shaq Harrison set up to be a really good one right now, because they're both playing really good. Ulis had 23 points last night on 9-16 field goals, three rebounds, two assists, only two turnovers. Actually, he made three threes as well, but Shaq Harrison continues to be really impressive. He's making a case for the Dan Majerle Hustle Award in like 15 games, but 6-12 field goals, 17 points, team leading plus 4 in that time. Excuse me, Alan Williams was plus 8, but for guys played over 25 minutes, Shaq was a plus-minus leader, but he had 4 rebounds, 2 assists, and also 4 steals once again. So I think Shaq, to me, is turning into a guy that I'm even more confident in him over Ulis at the moment as far as next season.
Yeah, I agree. I think last night was a really big step forward for him. I would love, I mean, I was talking to Eric Starr from, what is it, Solar Insights, is that the name of his site?
Yeah.
And he was kind of arguing, saying, you know, Shaq's better offensively than you give him credit for, and then of course he went and had this night, kind of proved me wrong a little bit as far as, you know, just this one game goes, but he looked really good. He can, it's not that he can't finish, like doesn't have the vertical quickness to get up and get to the rim or the quickness to get past defenders. It's really just that strength when a defender is trying to block his shot or there's some contact up in the air, he's unable to adjust and make those plays. So it's really, you see it in his game a lot. He's almost avoiding that stuff. So he's getting points in transition a lot, leaking out for dunks, or, you know, he gets his own steal so often that he's able to take it all the way to the rim pretty often. But it's still, three-point shooting is a little bit of a struggle, and playmaking as well. He's not really a traditional point guard. He's kind of more of an off guard that is the size of a point guard. So we'll see how it goes. I think, you know, summer league and a training camp next year and then make a decision wouldn't surprise me. Give him a non-guaranteed deal and kind of just see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. I think looking more at that situation, it's going to be really interesting to follow that moving forward. And with Shaq Harrison, don't you think that he could possibly guard, like you mentioned, twos and even, I don't know about threes, that's kind of a stretch, but Shaq Harrison's versatility at least gives you the opportunity of keeping all these guys on the roster next season, right? Like Davon Reed, Harrison, Ulis, all them together?
Yeah, I could see him being like a, you know, depending on where the roster goes, like a fifth guard when Booker's healthy, if, you know, whoever's starting at point guard and then they have a backup there, and then he's maybe like just a long depth guy. If they do end up keeping him on the roster, I could definitely see that, where spot minutes, opportunity to develop, and then, you know, measure his progress. I think he's a long way off from being like a regular rotation player on a good team, but I think there's at least a skill set there that you can project might be valuable going forward.
For sure. And I guess we should touch on Tyler Ulis a little bit more before we end today's episode. He had a strong night last night. What's your thoughts over the last four games? I think he's averaging about 17 points and 6 assists on 50% shooting. So is this the sort of Ulis that we're accustomed to seeing in late March just because the defense are sagging off more? Or what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that could be part of it. I mean, the Clippers holding the Suns to 99 points, I don't think is really something you give them credit for. I think it's really the Suns don't have any offense right now. So I thought the Clippers didn't really play that great of defense except for maybe the last like 14, 15 minutes of the game. They kind of locked in to take it home. But I think Ulis, it's the same. I mean, we're just seeing the same stuff. It's impressive that he's doing it consistently, getting up to those crazy minute totals that Earl Watson was forced to play him at the end of last year as well. Just tons of minutes for somebody that it faces such a physical disadvantage going up. I don't know why. It's always just incredible to me that he's able to play so many minutes when it's so tough for him to do everything physically on the court. But I mean, if he, yeah, he's another guy where, I mean, if he plays like this, it's really difficult for you to justify cutting him. Again, kind of rather just take him into the next season and into camp and then try to see if he makes sense as a piece. But he's definitely taking this opportunity seriously and producing. That's good to see for a young player who, I mean, like we were talking, is he going to be in the league next year at one point this season?
Yeah, that's a crazy, like, 180 Ulis has done over the last 6 weeks. But I think it's also crazy to say that Elfa Payne went from being one of the best bright spots of the season for the Phoenix Suns in three-game time period right after the trade, and all of a sudden he looks like the guy, the odd man out now, because Shaq Harrison's been better than him, Tyre Ulis has been better than him, and I think this, the free fall of Elfa Payne has been kind of a subplot storyline I've been following. Just what's your thoughts on Pete didn't play last night due to quote-unquote knee tendinopathy, but Dean, this might be a point where Payne maybe not even sees the floor much the rest of the season.
Yeah, I think Triano's basically at wit's end with him. The knee stuff, I have no idea what to say about that. That kind of came out of nowhere. Didn't get mentioned really at all on Monday when we were at the Celtics game, and then I turned on last night's game, and he's on the injury report. That was a little weird, but maybe it's just soreness. There's no need for him to be playing this late. I don't think he'll miss the rest of the year or anything. Like Booker and Warren probably will, but at the same time, it doesn't make a difference. I don't think he's not been productive and doesn't really seem engaged. I think he's kind of moved on to free agency, and I think we probably should too. Like we were talking about last night, like that's the bigger concern for him right now, because you know it's tough to envision a role for him if he thinks of himself as a starter or a big part of a team. He's really shown now in two different cities that he's not that kind of player, and wasn't able to make that difference for the Suns. And if he's not able to do it for the Suns, it's kind of tough to see who, you know, what really he could do.
Yeah, honestly, what do you think his value is going to be this summer? If he's just tanking on the Suns like this, and he did so in Orlando as well, just it's really proven to be just an empty stats kind of guy. Do you think he gets like any sort of offers this summer? Because I honestly get the point. We touched on it last episode, but I think at this point, I think McDonough might as well just send his qualifying offer to Payton before it even begins.
Yeah, I would anticipate that they'll probably do that. I just don't see him sticking around if he's not even playing at the end of this awful year with how little talent there is to go around. But I mean, like I said, I think if he can buy into the role that he is potentially going to be good in, which is just like a middle end, high end backup type of player for a team with shooting and into like a role man and shooting, and then he can really just be that playmaker driver that he has shown himself. That's when he's most efficient. And so I think if you put him in that role, it could work. But I guess if it just based on, you know, how much he's dominated the ball when he has it in all these different situations, even when it doesn't look like that's the most efficient option for him, that just frustrates me. And it kind of shows me that maybe he's not willing to take that back seat. But, you know, I guess it'll just be a matter of which teams sit him down and try to convince him of that. And if he goes to be a starter somewhere, I don't think it'll end well.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. I think not only Orlando, but Phoenix has seen what Elfa Payne has been like, and I think that's not really going to change anytime soon. But that'll do it for today's episode, guys. Appreciate you listening in. We covered today's game and also the tank race for you. But we have a special episode coming later, so we're going to actually cover Luka Doncic versus DeAndre Ayton for you guys. I know those are the two top candidates on our board and on most Suns board, but we're going to try to work on having a few special guests for an episode. But until then, guys, we'll talk to you later.